Corinthians 12:15. And in Romans chapter 1, Paul expresses gratitude as he did in many other passages. And this one especially gives us insight into how a grateful person or collection of people in a church can show God their gratitude. Here in Romans 1, beginning in verse 14, Paul acknowledges that he's a debtor. That word implies thanksgiving, the recognition that he owes other people for the benefits that he's enjoyed. Notice in verse 14, I am a debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, to the wise and to the unwise. Now, Paul's thankful. His heart is filled with gratitude. How is he going to express that thanksgiving? Well, there are different ways. We can express thanksgiving verbally, or we can express thanksgiving through prayer, or we can express thanksgiving through deeds. And it's the third that Paul expresses in the next verse. So, in view of the debt that he owes, in view of the gratitude that he feels, so, as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are at Rome also. So Paul said, I'm indebted for the things that I have learned in different fields to different people. And so I'm going to turn and pay back that debt by teaching others the gospel. And then he goes into that famous passage, Romans 1:16. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Of course, he began that verse by saying, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. And so on this weekend that we've been giving thanks and we've been thinking about our blessings, seems to me it would be appropriate to talk about a grateful church this morning in our class as we think about how we can show God how grateful we are for what He's done for us, not just by saying it, not just by praying it, not just by singing it, but by showing it as a congregation in building God a great church. You see, we really show our gratitude when we teach others the gospel. We really show God how deeply thankful we are when we're willing to sacrifice, to spend, and be spent for Him, as Paul expressed it in 2 Corinthians. So let's go into just a simple lesson that shows the component parts of a successful church-building effort. I'm not talking about sticks and stones and concrete and sheetrock, but I'm talking about building blocks of a spiritual nature, that those things that we have at our disposal that will help us to build the kind of church that will bring glory to God and save people. I remember reading that Tom Landry, longtime coach of the Dallas Cowboys, world champions in at least in 1971, he said his priorities were set like this: Christ first, family second, football third. I do not believe he was a New Testament Christian after the ancient order, but I do think that he had his priorities right if he lived by that motto. And you and I should always have Christ first, family, and then job or recreation or entertainment. But what he had done in expressing that, he had decided there were three main areas of his life. There were three component parts to who he was. And so the church needs to do that. We need to see what is there in our repertoire, what is there in our arsenal, what is there in the cupboard that we can use to show gratitude to God, to build God a great church. And there are four things that we'll discuss in our lessons today. So let's just go right into it. Let's see in the first place and talk about people. Jeremy's going to read for us in a moment Romans chapter 12. You'll be turning there, Jeremy, beginning in verse 3. I'll go ahead and give you an outline of where we're going. I think that will help to put the pieces together. So let me give you the four component parts of a successful church building effort. Number one, personnel. Number two, vision. Number three, work ethic. And number four, leadership. Those are what we have to build a great church. And each one of them brings something different to the table. Let's talk first about personnel determines potential. Churches are not built on paper. They're built in real life. They're not built by plans and thoughts. They're built by deeds and actions. When you think about two churches. The church is always built in a local community by the people of the church. You have two churches. One of them, let's just say they were established at the same time. One of them in the next 25 or 100 years will go from just a handful of members to 100 or 200 or 500 members. The other one will grow a little, maybe to 25, maybe to 50, maybe plateau at 75. Now, they're preaching the same gospel. They're praying to the same God. They're offering the same salvation. And yet one has a lot of baptisms and the other has only a few. One grows numerically and is able to do more things in the world to carry the gospel to various places and to help others and to build the faith of those in attendance. But the other one just seems to be stagnant. Now, why is that? Well, certainly there are extenuating circumstances. It may be that one is planted in a part of the world where the children grow up and move away and find jobs. And another one may be in the location where those children move to find jobs. One may be in a community that has an army base or that has a good factory base, and so there are plenty of jobs to keep people there, and another may be in a declining area. But all things being equal, you could plant two churches in the same city, and one of them might grow and become a great church, and the other one would not. And so what's the difference? The difference is personnel determines potential, the members that make up that church, and what they're willing to sacrifice in order to see that church grow. Therefore, as a congregation, we need to invest in people. And as you look about the kinds of people that need our investment or our emphasis, you can look at Jesus' life. When he came to earth, he was here for 33 years. No one ever did more than he did. And what did he emphasize? Three things. He emphasized first his relationship to God. He was spiritual. You find him out, Mark 1:35, for instance, he arose before day and went out to a solitary place and prayed. Jesus emphasized his relationship to God. Number two, he emphasized training his 12 successors or his 12 apostles whom he would leave behind when he went back to heaven. And number three, he emphasized helping the world. He came to seek and to save that which was lost, Luke 19:10. So one of the three major areas of Jesus' life had to do with pouring himself into other people, investing his resources in these 12 men so that when he no longer was on the scene, they could carry on the work that he wanted done on the earth. Now, churches need to do the same thing. And there are five areas, and of course you could expand this, but let's just touch on five investments in people the church needs to make. Number one, the church needs to invest in children. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of youth, Psalm 127, 1-3. And that passage talks about his quiver being full of them and the blessing of children. And just as you can aim an arrow and shoot it to a place that you could never go, over a wall, for instance, or over a river, parents and, by extension, churches can shoot children, can point children in a direction where we will never be, that is, in the future. All things being equal, the older ones will pass from the scenes of this life and we will be replaced by those who at one time were just toddling children, and then they were teens, and then they were young adults, and now they are in a position to do the work that God wants done when we're no longer able to do it. When Jesus was on earth, he did not ignore children. Jesus felt that children were important enough to invest time in them. You remember in Matthew 18, 1-3, when Jesus, the disciples were squabbling as they sometimes did, he called a little child unto him in the midst of them. Well, children seem to have been close to Jesus at other times, we'll see. But he called one. He said, except you become as a little child, you should not enter the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 19, 14, Jesus said again, speaking of children, suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. I have time for children. I want to hold them. And he brought them up into his arms and blessed them, the Bible says, and so invest in children. What does that mean? Well, as a church, children are not just distractions to be gotten out of the assembly and put somewhere else. They're not just, we're not just in the babysitting business to somehow keep them occupied until they get old enough not to bother us when we're trying to worship. No, we're investing by teaching them the principles that will build their lives, that will bring about faith in their hearts. And so we as a congregation should have as a goal building the greatest Bible school we're capable of building. Not one that's just mediocre, not one that just somehow is the same thing we've always done, but be open to finding the best curriculum to teach them. By providing the best environment for them to learn. You know, the high schools, the elementary schools, the universities invest millions of dollars in buildings and equipment and training to teach our children to read and to write. And that's important. But if you were to put a priority to one over the other, wouldn't it be the things that we teach are more important than what they will learn in school? They need both, but certainly if you could only have one, you would want them to learn about Jesus and how to be saved from sin. So emphasize children. Number two, let's say invest in children. Let's say number two, involve teens, converts, and transfers. As young people grow old enough to obey the gospel, we should involve them in every part of the work that they're capable of being successful in. One obvious thing is when a young man reaches the age to be baptized, he becomes a Christian, we'll involve him in the Lord's Supper, serving the emblems. That's a great honor, and he can do that very well. Involve them in leading the church in prayer. What an honor it is for a church to bow and to be the one that expresses the thoughts to the very one who has rule of the universe. Here you have also young ladies growing up, teaching them to be able to teach in the Bible classes. Maybe be an assistant teacher for a time. Be involved in vacation Bible school in some capacity. Go to carry the cake that she has baked over to the widow who's going through a time of grief. And on, but involve them in the different works of the church. The same thing is true in new converts. Now, they're babes, the Bible says, Hebrews 5, 12 to 14. So you don't want to put a new convert up trying to address the audience, preaching a sermon. Now, they may get there, and some faster than others, but involve them in areas where they're capable of being successful and where they can stretch themselves, can learn. And then what about new members? When new members come in, help them to become identified with the church. Find out what their interests are, what their talents are, what they could contribute to the work. Every person that places membership with this congregation has something to contribute to the work. And certainly we are small-sided if we have more people than we have work to do. When there's a whole world that's lost, when there are so many people in our community who are hurting, when there are so many children that are without parents to influence them for good and God, certainly, there's plenty of work to do, so we should seek to immediately involve those who come into this community and identify with the church. Let's talk about a third group. Incorporate women into the work of the church. The Bible, of course, defines the roles of men and women in the church. Men being assigned leadership roles, including the public worship assignments. But the Bible says that there is a role for women to play. In Galatians 3:28, when it comes to salvation, there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male nor female. We're all equal at the cross of Christ. And everyone has something to contribute. And so we make a terrible mistake if we do not involve the talents of the women in the congregation. And in almost every church that I've ever been a member of or even visited, there are more women than there are men. There's two reasons for that. One, women outlive men. Wives bury their husbands more often than husbands bury their wives. You think about the widows of a church then. What an asset to a church. And another reason why you have more women is that women are more frequently tender-hearted enough to receive and obey the gospel. You'll often have women who will be very spiritually minded and very active with the church, but a husband who has little interest and may not even attend worship services at all when she gets ready and gets the kids ready and takes them to the classes and to the services. And so women have much to offer. We ought to make sure that we utilize, that we incorporate their talents in the plan of work. Number four, initiate men into service of the Lord. See, there's a flip side of that coin. And there are many denominational churches that have an increased role for women in their services beyond the bounds of Scripture, where they may have a woman preaching and leading the prayer and the singing. But you know what's often happening in those churches? The male membership is going steadily down. So that in some, especially smaller churches, you have virtually no men, only women and children. You see, God's plan works best, and it always ought to be followed. In the case of what that does is it reinforces the stereotype that religion is just for women and kids, women and children. And men, seeing not having the role that God assigned them, become disinterested. So we ought to develop the talents of the young men in the church. The teenagers we already mentioned, but also as they progress into college and then young adult and young marrieds and married with children in the middle age, there ought to be a steady progression as their faith increases, their knowledge increases, and their responsibilities increase. And elders are wise to reach out and to help each man to reach his full potential. And you might also put on that point 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. And on the previous point, I see several of you making notes. You might also put down on the women Mark 14:8, where it says, "She hath done what she could." If every woman in the church did what she could, oh, how the work of Christ would soar. If every man, by extension, did what he could, you know, just reached our potential, oh, what we could do for God. Then number five, harness the potential of the retirees. Harness the potential of the retirees. We live in a time when people are living longer. In our lifetime, the life expectancy has increased, possibly by as much as 10 years. Since you were born, your expected lifespan has increased by that much. What that means is that many people are retiring, some even retiring early, and then they have much longer, many years of good health, good minds. And so most churches have a great resource in their senior members. So we ought to utilize that. You see, developing personnel helps the church reach its potential. I remember reading that during the reign of Oliver Cromwell over in England, they had a shortage of silver for making coins. And so he sent some of those in his employ out to the churches to see if they didn't have some precious metals that could be used. And so they came back later and they said, no, they don't have any loose metals or any stored. All of their silver is in the statues in the corners. And Cromwell said, good. Let's melt down the saints and put them in circulation. You know, every saint, you and me, needs to be put into circulation. And we've been beginning to plan for 2016, talking about what the church can do, what we should do. One of the goals that this church has and every church should have is to get every member involved. You see, personnel determines potential. And if you don't utilize your personnel, you'll never reach your potential. Now, that can come from top down, and that also can come from grassroots up. What that means is our elders can come to us and say, we believe you have a talent in this area. Would you mind taking on this work? And that's a good thing for elders to do, but it also can go the other direction. It can be some of us going to the elders and say, you know, I would like to be more involved. What is there that, how could I help? You see, top down are grassroots up. Either way, it works. Now, if you're looking for, if you want to become more involved in the church, there are four questions to ask, and these are very important. If I only have one thing to leave with you when this lesson is over, this would be it. And this is what Jeremy's going to read to us here, and just read a section of this from Romans chapter 12. Ask this question, number one, what is my interest and passion? You say, I want to be more involved in the church. Well, how do I know what to be involved in? Number one, what are you interested in? You know, all things being equal, we will be more involved, that is, to a greater degree, for a longer duration, if it's something we have a personal interest in, than if it's something somebody hands us and says, here, do this. Well, depending on our personality and our degree of faith and commitment, we'll probably do what it is they've asked us to do. It may even become a passion with us over time. But if it's something that we really have a personal interest in, and we say to the elders, I would like to be involved with the young people, or I really have a passion for evangelism, or, you know, I was sick when I was a child for several years, and I just really want to help people who are hurting. What could I do? You see, if I have a personal interest in it, then I'm more like, so that's my first question to ask myself is, what is my interest or passion? In 2 Kings 10:14, Jehu said, come, see my zeal for the Lord. All of us need to have a zeal for the Lord in general, but also a specific zeal for certain work that we are really involved in. Now from Romans chapter 12, this is one of the body chapters of the New Testament along with 1 Corinthians 12 and Ephesians 4. And if you're looking for work to do in the church, see if any of these would be of interest to you. Jeremy, read for us Romans 12, 3 through 8, please. All right, stop there just for a minute, Jeremy. So to set the stage here, what he's done so far is just said God gives grace to everybody. He gives talents, abilities, opportunities to all of us. We are all a part of the body, so we have a function. And the different parts of the body have different functions. And now he's going to go in to some of these works that the early church was involved in. And these are there's some passages that don't, you could not say this about, like Ephesians 4. Some of those different categories we don't have in the church anymore because those who occupied, for instance, the office of apostle are still apostles. They don't need to be replaced. But in this case, each one of these is an ongoing work or ministry in the church in every generation. So go ahead, Jeremy, now pick up with your reading, please. Now notice, those are different works that you can do in the church. Now the prophecy would be, the application today, of course, would be to preaching, public preaching. And we certainly need those who are capable of preaching and filling the pulpits and carrying the gospel to various places. So it may be that you have an interest and you have the personality for it, you have the mind for it, you have the interest in being a preacher of the gospel. Maybe not full time. There are a lot of churches around that need someone who works a regular job, we'll say, during the week, but they can't afford to hire someone, and a lot, especially right now in the church, and this is more true now than it has been in previous years. They need someone to drive over and preach for them on Sundays, and there's a lot of good that's done in that kind of work. And some within driving distance of this building or where you live could really use someone to fill in, if not every Sunday, then sometimes. And then the next one, and I'm not going to go through all these, but let me just touch on them. Ministry. Do you have a heart to serve others? Or teaching, are you trained in teaching? We have a lot of people here who are trained to teach in public education. Boy, take that same training and apply it in a class. You could do so much good. Or maybe you just have an interest in it. You have a natural gift for it. And on down the list you can go. We won't take the time to look at all those, but I would encourage you to read through them and say, which one of these really is going to be my passion? Now, this is not exhaustive. There are others, but this is a good start. Second question, we're talking about four questions to ask to find your place in the body. Number two, what needs to be done? Every church has strengths and weaknesses. Every church has areas in which it excels in serving God and has areas where it really needs to do better. That will be true of this church. There are things that we do very well and things that we really could do and should do better. And so as you, as a, maybe a longtime member here, or maybe even a new member, begin to look around and say, what needs to be done? What this church would be better if, dot, dot, dot. How would you finish that sentence? Well, however it is, provided it's a scriptural answer to that open-ended sentence, that might be a good indication of what you should use your talents and time and energy for. This church could be better if somebody was working with the young people. Okay? Somebody somewhere never got anything done, did they? But I think I'll invest a little time in having the young people come over to my house. We'll have a devotional. I'll take them to a youth meeting. This church would be better if someone was teaching more Bible studies. There are a lot of opportunities that are slipping through the cracks that we aren't capitalizing on. Somebody somewhere never taught anybody the gospel, did they? But somebody saying, I'm going to set up a study with this person. Somebody else might say, this church would be better if it was more compassionate, paid more attention to its older members. You know, nobody needs to assign you a widow to check on or to go see, or an older couple whose health is failing to run by and say, you know, is there anything that needs to be done today? I have an hour or so. I don't really have, I just came over to visit. But if you need, you know, the grass mowed or light bulbs changed or the garbage carried out or, you know, the bedroom suit moved to a different room, whatever it is, I could come up. You see, what needs to be done? Esther 4:14 says, who knows whether thou art coming to the kingdom for such a time as this? God may have placed you here now to do this work, whatever it is that needs to be done. Number three, what talents do I possess? Everybody has talents. Some may be five talented people. And really, that's a misnomer. I think everybody's a five talent person, probably a 25 talent person. We have many things we can do. The talents in Matthew 25:14-31, of course, are his amount of money. And so he based how much money he gave to these people to invest based on how he judged their ability to be successful at it. So he gave to 1 5, 1 3, 1 1. But what talents do you possess? Well, sometimes we don't know. We have innate talents that we've never tapped before. One thing I think is really good that this church does, many churches do, and we probably could even do better, is to give young people the opportunity to see what their talents are. They don't know. You know, get them up there leading singing, the young men, and see, they may really take to that like a duck to water. Another one might say, oh, I just can't carry a tune in a bucket. That's not my thing. Another lads of leaders, he may make a speech, he may do very well, and he may say, you know, I seem to have a talent for this. Or, well, on and on you could go, but give them opportunities as parents to be exposed to many different works in the church where they may something may spark. They may find that they have an interest and a talent in it. Same thing is true with adults, new members that come into the church, or even those who've grown up but we've never done, you know, as much as we could. You know, volunteer. So let me try that. And then if you do well, do it, you know, but it may be, no, this one I'm not really good at. Somebody else could do better. So what talents do I possess? That's Matthew 25:14-31 and 2 Timothy 2:19-21. In a great house, there are different vessels. You know, some to honor, some to dishonor, gold, silver. So a church has many different top members and they have different abilities. Then number four questions to ask. What opportunities do I have? I was talking to someone recently who had an interest in being a youth director. But the church where he was attending already had a good youth director. You know, he had an interest in it. Perhaps he had an aptitude for it. But there wasn't an opportunity to do it in that church at that time. So he should redirect his efforts at this point. You know, maybe he can be the right-hand man of the youth director. You know, anytime you need somebody to drive or you need a chaperone or you need somebody to fix a meal or snacks, you just call me. I'm ready to help any way I can. But that wouldn't be his main work. He may decide that he wants to do it full-time and see if there's another church that could use that. So what I'm saying is sometimes we don't have the opportunity to do what we might want to do, our first choice. And that happens all the time in the business world and in education. You know, we might not can get into our favorite college, but we go to another one, we do well there. We may make a bid on a certain job and somebody else may be more qualified or may be selected, and so we bid on a second one. So the same thing is true in the church, but that's another question to ask. What opportunities do I have? Galatians 6 and verse 10. And often opportunities are doors that God opens in a certain, you see that in the book of Acts. One door may close, like when Paul wanted to carry the gospel into Bithynia, Acts 16, but the Spirit forbade him. I don't know why, but the Spirit said no. But then another door opened to carry the gospel into Europe, and he preached in Philippi for the first time on European soil and had great success. And so sometimes God opens those doors. All right. That's all we'll say about number one, and we'll say more about that one than we will the others. So let's talk about number two, and this one very briefly. Vision determines direction. Our sermon in a few minutes is going to be on vision, so I'm not going to spend time here except to quote from Proverbs 21, verse 5, "The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty only to want." Now, you could get the meaning of that by substituting the plans of the diligent tend only to success. But of everyone that is hasty or that doesn't plan, just, you know, seat of the pants, only to lack or unsuccessfulness. So as a church, we need to have vision on where we could go, therefore where we should go. Number three. Work ethic determines progress. You can have the best plan laid out on paper. I mean, you can have it well thought out logically. You can have it expressed in a way that everybody gets it. Maybe it's designed in such a way as to be attractive to the eye. Maybe it's presented with great excitement. But if that plan of work just goes on a shelf, what have you really accomplished? Really, it becomes, a church begins to be successful when the members begin to roll up the sleeves and wipe the sweat off the brow, where we've actually gotten our hands dirty, we've actually gotten involved in doing the plan. You know, if we fail to plan, we plan to fail, that's true. But also, if we plan but don't do, we've failed. And so work ethic is involved. Let's think about a few scriptures along those lines. And in John 9, 4, Jesus was not too good to work. He said, "I must work while it is day, for the night cometh when no man can work." Jesus set the example for us. He worked. Even as a young man, he was impressed. He impressed others with his work ethic. In Luke 2, 49, you see that his zeal impressed those in John 2, 17 as he overturned the tables of the money changers. In 2 Corinthians 12, 15, a passage I mentioned earlier, Paul said, "I will gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more I love, the less I be loved." I think there's a lot in that verse. I will gladly spend, I will invest my money, but I will also be spent. I will invest myself in the work of the church. We ought to be willing to do one, but we really need to do both. And in some projects, it may be that we can, you know, not all of us can go be missionaries, but we could all be a missionary by helping someone go. We can't all run an orphan's home, but we can all help run the orphan's home by supporting the needs that they have. So I will gladly spend and be spent. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Let me stop there, and inasmuch as we know that our labor is not in vain in the Lord, let me just ask this pointed question. And I'm asking it of me as I ask it of you. Can I honestly say that verse is true of me? That I am abounding in the work of the Lord? Or am I going through the motions? Or am I doing the bare minimum? Or am I sort of serving half-heartedly? I mean, maybe a little more than that, but I'm not abounding. You see, if that's true, I need to think about that verse again. That's not just a suggestion. It'd be a good idea if... No, he says, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. So that's imperative, a command. So all of us take that to heart, and that increases. And of course, we sort of ebb and flow in our Christian lives. But sometimes when we're reminded again, that's true. You know, that's in the Bible. It helps us to, again, to flow, to step up to the plate. In the Middle Ages, church officials would often preach on the seven deadly sins. They're not found in the Bible. Not at least. There are seven things that God hates in Proverbs 6, but that wasn't what they used. Some of them were there. But you know what the first one was? Seven deadly sins. Sloth. S-L-O-T-H. That one's not found in the Bible as in a list of seven, but it surely is found in the Bible. Proverbs 6, 6 to 9, go to the ant, thou sluggard, and learn her ways. You see it also in Matthew 25, 26, that one talent, the person who had one talent and hid it, he was called a wicked and slothful servant. He had not done anything that we would call wicked. I mean, he just didn't do anything, didn't do what the master expected him to do. And then in 2 Peter 1, 5 and 10, the list of the Christian virtues, add to your faith virtue and so forth, it begins in verse 5, giving all diligence. And it ends in verse 10, again, giving all diligence. So, beginning and ending of adding to our Christian lives is to add diligence. Now, ask this question. If every member of this church were like me, what kind of church would this church be? How zealous would the church be? How generous would the church be? How hardworking would the church be? How sound would the church be? How worshipful would the church be? If everyone were like me. You remember that question that Judas asked? You know, we don't use Judas very often, do we? Lord, is it I? That's a good question. And in that case, it was him. He was the one who would betray him. But that's a good question. Lord, is it I who's holding the work of the church back? Lord, is it I that needs to do more? Lord, is it I whose work ethic could improve? I came across this statement, and I'm not really sure who I'm quoting here. But this is the one statement of this section that's just been marinating in my mind. We will be what we are becoming. Let that sink in. We will be what we are becoming. You know, sometimes we have the idea that somewhere later in life, I'm going to have a transformation. I'm going to become, you know, more dedicated. I'm going to do great things. Well, once in a while, there will be a transformation like that in a person's life, but most of the time, we become what we are becoming. The direction that we're going now is where we will end up. And so if I want to change the ultimate course of my life, the only thing I can change is my today. I can become today more, and that will affect my tomorrow. 1 Corinthians 3:10 says, take heed how you build thereon. Well, I'm going to save that section. That's a very important section. I'm not going to take time. I won't have time to do that. So let me just give you number four, and I'll come back and discuss that with you at a later date of how to build the three principles, imperatives of building a strong church. Let's talk about number four as we close. Leadership determines success. A church never rises above its leadership. It's not possible. And so leadership determines success. There are two things that members can consider doing to make our elders and our deacons and our preachers, our leadership in the church, especially the elders as they are over the church, we can respect and encourage them. 1 Thessalonians 5, 12-14. How can I make this the leadership of this church better? Respect and encourage them. Hebrews 13, 17 also goes on that line. So express that respect. Offer that encouragement. Makes a lot of difference in leadership to have members who respect and encourage them. Then the second thing that members can do, and we've touched on this already, is take on a project. Do something that will encourage. That's Isaiah 6, 8, "Hear my Lord, send me." And then what can leaders do? They can create a sense of belonging and value and team in the church. That's 1 Corinthians 12, 14 through the end of the chapter. I think that's 31. So create cohesion in the church that will help the church to feel like a body and each one to use their part and recognize that even those that are new members or young members or old members or less talented members or poor members, whatever their demographic may be, they also contribute significantly to the work. Somebody said there are three groups in the church: those that make things happen, those who watch things happen, and those who never know what happens. You know, and it's elders that try to move the third group and the second group into the first group so that all of us are a part of the ones who are making things happen. And every part of the body, even the parts that are not really significant, are important to us. And I dare say that most of us in here spent some time on our hair before we came here. You know, we stood in front of a mirror. Maybe this week, some point, you went to a barber or to a stylist. You know, some of these young ladies will spend maybe an hour in front of a mirror, or maybe they'll sleep in some kind of thing that's not so comfortable. So their hair will look really pretty when they come today. You know, but when you went to the barber and he cut off part of it, and you lost all interest in that hair. You didn't ask, "Can I keep that?" You don't have any interest in it anymore. I want to comb that when I get... No, you don't have any interest in it. I'm going to wash that hair that you cut off when I get... No, yes, though. Why is that? It's not connected to the body anymore. Your value, my value in the church is that I'm connected to Christ. What I do for Him. I have value because I'm a part of His body. That's 1 Corinthians 12. It's also John chapter 15. I know our time's up, but John 15 talks about the branch and the vine. And when the branch is separated from the vine, it dies. It's not fruitful anymore. And so my value, worth, comes from my connection to the Lord and what I'm doing in His kingdom. Well, thanks for your attention this morning, and we'll be dismissed into the worship hour.